Okay, so it's a pleasure to talk to you this morning. I'm going to talk about new treatments. So Dr. Foley already talked about some new treatments that are already in clinic, like bendamustine, and some treatments that are coming very close, like ibrutinib, and I'll talk about a few other ones that I think we would hope to expect in the clinic, maybe in the next year or two, which we hope are going to improve both the treatment experience, making things easier, and also the success of treatment by hopefully treating the disease more effectively. So I did want to mention a few things. This is kind of what I want to cover in the next half an hour or so, how important clinical trials are in our day-to-day lives and the treatment we provide to people, how drug development happens, because people, and we're frustrated as well, how long does it take a drug to come to market? Why does it take 10 years for a drug to come to market so we can actually start using it in people? And then I'll talk about some of these new agents. Some I can skip over, like bendamustine, since Ronan already went over it, or ibrutinib, but I'll talk about a couple of other ones that are just on the cusp of coming into the market. And then new uses for some drugs that we're using a lot of, like Revlimid is a drug commonly used in myeloma, but it's also coming into lymphoma. So this has been one of our success stories in the last 40 years, treatment of childhood acute leukemia. If you look way back in the 1960s here, pretty much all kids died of leukemia. The survival rate was 20%, right? So it was a devastating disease. Back then, there was no new drugs. People were using conventional, very rudimentary chemotherapy. And what has happened since then? Now, and this slide is even old, now the majority of kids are cured from acute leukemia. And why is that? The disease hasn't changed, but the treatment has. And that's because people were disciplined. They got together, big groups got together, and they basically created new cocktails of chemotherapy drugs, sometimes new drugs added in, and they did a very quick succession of randomized clinical trials where newer treatments were compared to older treatments, and the newer treatments were better and better and better and better, and we've now reached the point now where a kid with acute leukemia is expected to be cured. So this requires discipline, not only from the researchers, but from people treating the disease, and of course, if patients don't participate in clinical trials, you'll never see this benefit. And this is the type of clinical trials that are done. So preclinical studies here means that the drug is identified either in an animal model or in the test tube to have disease activity. It moves from the preclinical phase into phase one studies, which means that you're testing the drug in a few patients, maybe 20 patients or 30 people. It's a bit of a test because you want to know how much of the drug can you give to a human being safely? Because prior to that, it's never been tested in humans. So the first in human studies are phase one studies, and you basically want to see, does it make people sick, and what's the right dose? Once you figure that one out, then the drug moves into phase two studies, where you want to say, you've gotten the dose right, how good does it work? What's the efficacy? What's the response rate? And what are the toxicities? And usually in phase two studies now, you're able to test the drug in more people, say 50 or 60 or 100 people. Phase three studies are the ones where the rubber hits the road. So a phase three clinical trial means you're going to test the drug that you think is good against some standard. So in Ronan's example, when Rituxan came on the market, the pivotal study was the phase three study where it was added to CHOP. Half the patients got CHOP, standard chemotherapy, and the other half of the patients got CHOP with this new drug called rituximab at the time. The phase three studies are critical because those are the studies that often lead to drug approval and then subsequently funding by the governments, right? These have to be big studies. You're talking about studies now that are hundreds of patients, typically across different countries with multiple institutions. So they're very big studies, they're very expensive to run, and that partly accounts for why drugs, when we have to pay for them in the end, are often expensive to pay for. Phase four studies are not really studies, but they're more like post-marketing surveillance, because when you bring a drug, say even like rituximab, through this process, by the time it gets approved and marketed and paid for after a phase three study's been done, or multiple phase three studies, You'll have had maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people on the drug worldwide, which is not a bad number. But now there's probably millions of people who have used rituximab. And so sometimes you want to keep a tab on rituximab even after it's gone out of the market, just in case you start to see rare side effects. So post-marketing surveillance is very important because you want to screen the drug for unusual toxicities when it's used on a global scale. This was a nice slide to show why it takes so long for drugs to reach the market. So, and this is a generic slide you can use for almost any drug, even a blood pressure pill for that matter. So it takes 3 to 5 years to discover a drug and to do the preclinical studies. These are the studies in test tubes or in animal models to determine its effectiveness. And then it takes a couple of years or so to optimize the drug. Sometimes the preclinical studies suggest that the drug is not optimal, like it might be hard on a kidney or liver system or something like that. So the scientists have to fiddle with the drug to make it more acceptable. Then that takes a couple of years, basically, to look at the toxicology, right? You do experiments in typical animal models to define what is the side effect profile before you want to even go to human beings. And then it takes a year or two to develop the manufacturing capacity, the factories, the assembly lines, the biological systems to make these drugs. And as we get away from chemical drugs into more fancy drugs, the manufacturing process gets even more complicated. And then you're ready for clinical trials. So it takes 7 to 10 years, 12 years sometimes, for a drug from initial identification by a scientist somewhere to actually be prime time ready to enter human clinical trials. If you have drugs already on the market that you want to repurpose for another disease, that often is a little bit easier because some of that background work has already been done, the toxicology, the manufacturing, etc. But now you've identified, for example, Revlimid is a good example where we've used it for many years in myeloma. Now we're thinking of using it in lymphoma. Well, we can just move right into a clinical trial. So somebody saw that it might have worked in lymphoma. You want to test it perhaps in a limited animal model, for example, or a cell-based system. And then you know, your manufacturing is okay, then you're ready to move into clinical trials. And then hopefully it leads to FDA or Health Canada approval. So this process gets sped up. It could be done usually within 2 to 5 years. So that's another way that drugs get approved. The traditional chemotherapy that Ronan talked about is limited by side effects. So the thinking here is that if you can give more chemotherapy drugs to kill a cancer, if you can increase the dose of the drugs, you will kill more cancer cells. The problem is that you will produce more side effects. So there is a limit to how much chemotherapy somebody can take. The initial side effects that you get are largely related to the blood counts, and we have ways of getting around that with drugs like white cell stimulators like Neupogen or G-CSF, or in the case of transplantation, by giving the person back their own stem cells. So we have ways of getting around the blood count issue. So once we're beyond the blood count, then we're able to kill cancer cells or lymphoma cells in this range here at a certain chemotherapy dose before causing organ toxicity, which we really want to avoid. This would be toxicity to the kidneys or the liver or to the lungs or the heart, because those toxicities are hard to manage and they could be very significant. So the effect of traditional chemotherapy, there's this little window here of opportunity where you can manage the toxicities and you're trying to kill the most cancer cells, but it has its limits. As Ronan has shown you, we don't know yet. There's lots of things you could target. So here's one little cartoon showing all the different enzymes and proteins interacting with each other in a cancer cell. And this isn't a lymphoma cell. This could be any cancer cell. And lymphoma cells can share the same cell processes that a breast cancer cell might have, or a lung cancer cell, for example. So these things are not necessarily exclusive. But if you're a scientist, you've got lots of targets here to pick, to try and hit, to try and interrupt the survival signal that cancer cell needs to stay alive. And on the surface of the cells, in lymphoma cells in particular, we do have cellular targets, surface targets that Ronan showed, CD antigens that we can target. And the one that we've targeted so far most successfully is CD20, which is the target that rituximab hits. And that's why I think rituximab has been such a success story for us in the last 10 or 20 years. But there are lots of other targets. So you say, well, why aren't we chasing the other targets? And people have. It's just that just because you have a target on the cell and an antibody to hit the target doesn't mean it's going to work. And there's already been big clinical studies doing testing two targets like CD80, galiximab, and CD23, limoliximab. Those studies failed because the antibody hit the target, but that did not kill the cell effectively. So this is still a ripe arena, I think, for clinical trials, is to try and hit these surface targets on B cells most effectively. So that's the first thing I'd like to talk about, is what's happening with antibody therapy, or targeting the cells with immune antibodies against those targets. So it's basically you're trying to mimic the human immune system. And rituximab, of course, as you've heard, is the best example. So a human antibody is made up of protein here by the B cells, plasma cells, and it sticks to viruses, bacteria, targets on cancer cells to try and kill them. Antibodies are complicated molecules. They're pretty big, and it takes a lot of work to make them, but they fit their target very intimately. It's almost like a lock and key. So a CD20 antibody will not stick on CD40, for example, because it's specific to that CD20. And the immune system, as Ronan has shown you, there's a complicated interaction between the B cells, the production of antibody, and what they're trying to kill. And here's a B cell here becoming a plasma cell, making antibodies that will then go on and do their job, killing a bacteria, helping to kill a virus, or in some cases, to kill a cancer cell. Now, we can play with antibodies in the lab to change their character. So, of course, antibodies that we make naturally are human, right? They're all human protein because they're made from our human cells. Rituximab, for example, is called a chimeric antibody because it's half human, half mouse. The mouse part here in red is the part that sticks to the CD20 on the surface of the lymphoma cell. So you can create antibodies in mice that will stick to any surface target you want to develop. CD20 was the one chosen for rituximab, and that was successful. And then antibodies can be humanized. You know, you can change the proportion of mouse protein in the antibody, or they can even be primatized, meaning that the protein there is from primates. You move from the mouse model to the primate model, and sometimes even to the human model. You can make totally humanized antibodies as well. You would not give a human a pure mouse antibody because your immune system would kill it, would destroy the antibody before it had a chance to kill the cancer cell. So most antibodies now in production in cancer or other diseases where they're useful tend to be either chimeric, humanized, primatized, or fully human versions. And here we have some on the market already that are these different flavors. So rituximab, you've already heard, is the best example of chimeric antibodies. But there are antibodies like alemtuzumab or Campath. That's a fully humanized antibody that hits CD52 on the surface of lymphocytes. There's an antibody that's been developed for acute leukemia that hits CD33. And there's bevacizumab, which is a VEGF that's used for solid tumors like colon cancer, for example. And breast cancer has trastuzumab. So there's a number of antibodies already on the market that are being used. Panitumumab here is a fully human antibody that's used for colon cancer. The only other ones that we have now on the market for lymphoma other than rituximab and alemtuzumab is the radioactive antibodies. So these are antibodies that hit CD20, like rituximab, but they're not naked. Rituximab is naked. There's nothing. It doesn't have anything. It doesn't carry any baggage with it. It doesn't carry any missiles. It's just a normal antibody that sticks onto the surface of the cells. But these two guys here, ibrutumumab and tocilizumab, they have radioactive pieces added to their ends. So when they stick onto the lymphoma cell, they're able to kill the cell with targeting a little piece of radioactivity right to that cell. This is similar to the picture Ronan showed, showing all the different ways that rituximab works. And even though we're not 100% sure what happens with rituximab, we know that it's often a very effective cell killer through different mechanisms. Now, there is a new antibody called GA101 or obinutuzumab, and that one, I think we're hoping, some of the studies in CLL look very positive, and I suspect the drug will probably get FDA and Health Canada approval in the next year or two. But what they did for this antibody is it still is targeting CD20, but it's a newer version of rituximab. They've glycoengineered it, they've changed the antibody structure, and it's basically, it kills the cells more potently. It's a more aggressive killer of the cells, even though it sticks onto the same antigen. So we're hoping that GA101 or obinutuzumab is going to be our next new antibody to use that will, at some point, perhaps replace rituximab. The studies are ongoing. We have one on the market already called brentuximab. I would say that that's an antibody with a punch, because what they did for brentuximab is they made an antibody to a cell surface target called CD30. CD30 is not usually on B-cell lymphomas. It's usually on some of the T-cell lymphomas, or a version called anaplastic large cell, or in a related disease like Hodgkin's lymphoma or Hodgkin's disease has CD30 on the surface. And this, the development of this one is very smart, because if you give these cells a naked CD30 antibody, it does nothing. It doesn't work. But what they did is they put a little chemo on the end of the antibody, something like vincristine, which is a common drug that we use. So they put a little bit of vincristine-like substance on the end of the antibody. The antibody sticks onto the cell, the CD30 cancer cell. It goes in the cell, which normally it does. The cell takes it in, says, welcome, come on in, have some dinner. Now what happens, though, when it gets into the lysosome, the antibody gets released, and you're delivering that little vincristine molecule that was sitting there, it directly poisons the DNA as the cell divides. So you're using the antibody to deliver chemotherapy right into the middle of the cell. Very effective drug. So for anaplastic large cell lymphoma, you can see here, this is one study that was done years ago. Look at, and these bars here show the percentage reduction in the lymph nodes when given this antibody. So you can see some patients here, virtually complete disappearance of all lymph nodes with just an antibody therapy. So the drug has been approved by Health Canada. It is currently going through a funding review. We sincerely hope we're going to have it available to give to people in the next few months, both for anaplastic large cell lymphoma and for Hodgkin's disease. But one example of an antibody with a punch. Bendamustine is another drug that we're already using, and this drug's, Dr. Foley's already talked about it. This is a way of rediscovering an older chemotherapeutic drug, and there's nothing really particularly fancy about bendamustine. If you look at its chemical structure, it's very similar to drugs that we use a lot of, melphalan, clorambucil, cyclophosphamide. These are chemotherapy drugs that have been around for decades. They took, basically, bendamustine is a structure, a different structure, where they added a drug called fludarabine in the middle, and they paired it with one of these alkylating agents, and they called it bendamustine. This was developed in East Germany way, way back, but because Germany was split, the drug never saw the light of day until about 10 years ago, when the Berlin Wall fell down, pharmaceutical companies from the West picked it up. They did the testing that was required in Europe, and then basically went to Europe, Japan, North America, and we're now, because the clinical studies are positive, we're now using it fairly routinely, and it's one of our go-to drugs now for people that have follicular-type lymphoma or other indolent lymphomas. And when the National Cancer Institute said, well, this is an old drug, how does it look? They have a cell algorithm. They sprinkle these drugs on cell systems to see, how does it kill the cells? Does it kill the cells like other drugs that we have, or does it kill the cells in a new way? And even though the drug is made from older drugs combined, it actually kills the cells in many times in a totally different mechanism, which explains why it doesn't have some of the traditional side effects of chemotherapy and why it might work so well. So bendamustine, we're using a lot of now. It's funded in Ontario for rituximab in indolent type of lymphomas as part of treatment. It also has activity in a sister disease called chronic lymphocytic leukemia or small lymphocytic lymphoma. It's given intravenously 2 days every month for 6 cycles. And people are now testing it in other types of lymphomas, like the T-cell lymphomas, other aggressive lymphomas, and even in Hodgkin's disease. So we're hoping to capitalize on its activity. The BTK inhibitors are a very totally new class of drugs. This refers to a drug Ronan talked about called ibrutinib. Ibrutinib is the first BTK inhibitor that will likely hit the market, hopefully in the next year or two. It's already been approved by the FDA for select populations of patients with mantle cell lymphoma. That just the approval was just 2 or 3 weeks ago. We're hoping that it's going to get approved as well in more diseases that it's being tested for. And what BTK inhibitors do is they interrupt a key pathway inside the B cell. Remember that big mess I showed of all the different pathways? So BTK inhibition, it seems like they've hit a good target this time that seems to work. This is the first-in-class inhibitor because there's a surface receptor called a B-cell receptor on the surface of most B-cells. And most lymphomas are of B-cell origin. So B-cell receptor signaling seems to be a very important pathway for these cells to stay alive. So when they developed this drug, it was a very potent inhibitor of that. So they've tested it now in follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, CLL. It recently got FDA approval for mantle. And there's tons of clinical trials now ongoing to test the drug in different diseases to try and get approval as quickly as possible. And this is how it works. So there's your B-cell receptor sitting on the surface of your lymphoma cell, right? The lymphoma cell is made up of lipid, of fat, cholesterol. So the B-cell receptor is there, and it's widely expressed on the cells. And these B-cell receptors are critical. These are receptors that the cells use to stay alive. The cell receptor there is linked, as Ronan has showed on another slide, to a number of other enzymes in the cell. Eventually, the pathway leads you down to the nucleus of the cell, which is the factory where the DNA lives. The DNA tells the cell what to do. So, and it's not just BTK inhibition, and this is not necessarily a new thing, but companies now have a PKC beta inhibitors. There are SYK inhibitors being tested, as well as other ibrutinib-like molecules to hit the B-cell receptor up here. But there's your BTK, Bruton tyrosine kinase, and that's the thing that ibrutinib hits right there, interrupting this very critical pathway that leads to the nucleus of the cell. So if you block BTK here, you can disrupt the cell signaling significantly enough to allow that cell to die. So I think they've hit on a nice little target here with ibrutinib that we hope is going to be a very important advance. We're hoping it's going to be the next big thing for a lot of different lymphomas. The other thing not to forget is not just to take the cell in isolation, right? Dr. Foley told you about how these lymphoma cells live in the lymph nodes. And I mean, they don't live there, they live there for a purpose. It's because they thrive in the lymph nodes, right? It's like being home and being fed, right? They love being there. So this is one example of CLL, but it's very similar in any other type of B-cell lymphoma, that the cell gets very comfortable with its microenvironment in the lymph node system or in the bone marrow. So sometimes you want to create an environment for the cell that's hostile. So you may not be able to kill the cell directly, but by creating a hostile environment, the cell wants to leave. And when it leaves, it's susceptible to being killed more easily. And that's in fact what happens when you give people ibrutinib. So patients that have CLL who get ibrutinib, what happens? Their lymph nodes shrink because the lymphocytes leave the lymph nodes. They come out into the blood. Ibrutinib forces them out because the B-cell receptor pathway also involves cell adhesion. So you sever that adhesion. The cells float onto the blood. In fact, the white blood cell count goes up after you give people ibrutinib. The cells then die and the white count goes down. So creating a hostile microenvironment is an important way of trying to kill lymphoma cells. Lenalidomide is a drug that's been on the Canadian market for years now. We use a lot of it in myeloma. It's one of our best drugs to treat people with myeloma, which is a related B-cell problem. So this would be repurposing a drug for another purpose. So lenalidomide or Revlimid is used in myeloma. It's basically a newer version of an old drug called thalidomide. So you remember what happened with thalidomide many decades ago? So unfortunately caused a lot of birth defects and grief and disability and mortality. However, you know, it kills myeloma cells very effectively. So thalidomide was the first immunomodulatory drug to come to market. Lenalidomide is a better version, and we use it routinely now with steroids like dexamethasone and other drugs in combination to treat people with myeloma, and it's a very successful drug. And because we've been using it for so long, we're very comfortable managing it, and patients are comfortable taking it. So you don't have to go back to square one if you want to develop this drug to treat people with lymphoma, because it's already there. How lenalidomide works is still a little bit of a mystery, but it has multiple effects on the cells. So lenalidomide can kill myeloma cells directly. It can affect the microenvironment. It makes the microenvironment hostile. It can affect bone, because people with myeloma do have issues with their bones. It prevents new blood vessels from growing, because blood vessels need to grow to feed the tumor. It prevents that from happening. And it helps prevent signaling that it prevents the cells from talking to each other. It's like cutting off your kids' cell phone plans so they can't talk to their friends, right? Their social life collapses. That's what happens here. That's what lenalidomide does. So it's a very effective drug. And the same mechanisms that it works through for myeloma, the same mechanisms would apply to lymphoma as well. So right now, lenalidomide is being tested in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in combination with chemotherapy, in follicular lymphoma, in mantle cell lymphoma, and in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And in fact, it got FDA approval for mantle cell lymphoma. And I'll show you on the next slide. Canada is going to be participating in a huge international trial called the Relevance Trial. This will be for folks with follicular lymphoma. It'll be an upfront study, people that have never had treatment. And it's trying to test Revlimid to see whether or not you can get away from giving people chemotherapy. And this is the design of the study. So it's going to be about 1,000 patients worldwide. It's being run from France. Canada's participating, US, Europe. People come with their lymphoma. They need to be treated for a variety of reasons. And they get randomized. This is a phase 3 study. This is the study, if it's positive, will lead to drug approval and then marketing and then adoption and use to the benefit of people. So the randomization here is a flip of the coin, 50-50. Half the people will get standard chemotherapy, which means, for us probably, bendamustine and rituximab, another very good combination for follicular lymphoma. That's the standard. Half the people will get that. The other half of the people will get the experimental treatment, which for this study is Revlimid with rituximab, because we know rituximab is valuable, so they're combining the Revlimid with rituximab. And they're looking at how many people are going to respond to the experimental treatment versus how many people are going to respond to the standard treatment. So responses are measured carefully with clinical assessments and CAT scans. And then people will go on to rituximab maintenance. We know about the benefits of that as well. So people will get 2 years of Rituxan as part of their standard treatment. So the people in this group here, so part of the nervousness sometimes of participating on a phase 3 study is people don't want to be seen as being guinea pigs. And I think that's not the right way of looking at it. I think the way of looking at it for a study like this is that no one is getting harmed in this study, because at a minimum, people are getting the standard therapy, right? They're getting the therapy that your doctor would have prescribed if Revlimid never existed, right? A standard therapy. And the exciting part is half the people will be getting the newer therapy that we're hopeful is going to be better. Now, what about if the new therapy is worse? Well, if the new therapy is not as effective, then standard therapy remains standard therapy. And that's part of the trials and tribulations of doing these phase 3 studies, that sometimes the studies will work, favoring the experimental arm, and sometimes they won't. And that's just the risk that we take in doing phase 3 clinical trials. These people up here will also get maintenance rituximab with lenalidomide for a period of spanning about 2 years. So we're very excited about this study, because if this study becomes positive for the experimental group here, this will change the way we think about follicular lymphoma. Right now, we've thought about follicular lymphoma and other lymphomas as being a chemotherapy necessary disease. this could be the first study to show us that, you know, maybe you don't need chemotherapy for these things. Maybe you can use an immune modulatory agent with a monoclonal antibody, and maybe the results would be the same, or maybe the results will be even better than traditional chemotherapy. So we're going to have this in Hamilton, probably first quarter of 2014. There's many hospitals in Canada participating through the NCIC clinical trials group, and like I've said, multiple centers in France and in the US, because people do see the value. So to summarize, and we have some time for questions before the break, I think traditional chemotherapy, as you've heard, is still our primary modality for treating lymphoma. It's our backbone of therapy. But we've been very happy to have rituximab for the last 15 years, but we're looking for something better now, and it's time to move on. So what's next? I've showed you already examples of new antibodies that we hope are going to hit the market. Already, we're using new chemotherapy drugs like bendamustine, and we're hopefully going to have new agents like BTK inhibitors in the clinic very soon to use, and also trying to repurpose old drugs like Revlimid to use more effectively in lymphoma. So we're hoping that these drugs make it to clinical trials and that the clinical trials are successful, because it's the success of clinical trials that will help us decide then what is the next new standard therapy. And of course, you can imagine how expensive these drugs are, right? When rituximab first came on the market, we couldn't believe how much this stuff cost. So a typical rituximab infusion cost about $3,000 to $4,000. So right now, with these newer drugs coming onto the market, we're actually very comfortable with what Rituxan costs. It seems cheap now by comparison. And there are generic versions coming on the market as well for rituximab. So it's not really an issue of the cost. It's just an issue of trying to find the best therapy to treat these things. And then let's worry about the cost later. Let's first get effective therapies, and then we'll work out the cost issues. We'll find a way around that. And I think what's going to happen is combinations of agents will be the most useful. So every time we've tested a drug by itself, it seems to work better when you start putting it together with other drugs. And that could be because, have you seen some of the complicated pictures I've shown and Ronan has shown about all these different enzymes and pathways into the cells? Sometimes hitting one part of that is not enough to kill the cell. The cells are smart. They find workarounds. They become resistant to drugs. So the theory here is that treating with multiple drugs, sometimes old drugs combined with new drugs, or sometimes combinations of new drugs, will be the way moving forward, and that's what we're hoping for. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and we've got some minutes before the break. Ronan and I are happy to take questions. Thank you. Question?
Yeah. In terms of, let's say these drugs are fairly effective, but to prevent recurrence of a problem after you've gone through chemo and it's proven effective, the original cause for getting the disease in the first place could probably be like genetically modified foods, chemicals in the water supply, whatever. Is there an understanding of how to prevent a recurrence of the disease, whether there are studies done with poisoning of the food system through genetic modification, preservatives, what have you?
It's a very good question. So prevention of relapse in a general term is one of our main goals. So it's one thing to give somebody an effective therapy that maybe makes the disease disappear completely, meaning like the person has a complete response. And although getting a complete response is very helpful and very encouraging, and it's something that we all strive for, there's no guarantee, even if you can't find the cell, there's no guarantee that this thing will never come back again, right? And the question is, why does it come back? So it's an unanswered question, unfortunately. There are clinical trials looking at preventative therapies, but they're all pharmaceutically based, right? They're all, like, for example, giving maintenance Rituxan. The benefit of maintenance Rituxan is it prevents recurrence, and that's how it makes people live longer. But it doesn't always work. So maintenance Rituxan doesn't work in large cell lymphoma. It works in follicular. So why doesn't it work in large cell lymphoma? What is it about those cells that are different than follicular? We quite don't understand that yet. There have been other drugs used in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma to prevent recurrence. Those don't seem to work very well either. So I do think we just need what there, and the people doing clinical trials or developing new drugs, this is like a big ticket item for them. to develop methods to prevent recurrence, but I can't say that we've landed on any way of figuring it. We're not sure the vast majority of the time what causes lymphoma in the first place, so therefore we're never sure what causes its recurrence either. But probably, you know, the issue with lymphomas and other cancers is often, you know, when these diseases recur, the recurring cells have a memory of what they've had before. So sometimes it becomes harder to treat people with the same drugs a second and a third time. They don't work as well because the cells have built resistance. And that's part of the ingenuity inside the cell, that it can develop resistance that will make treatment in the future more difficult. And that's part of the thrust for scientists to come up with new drugs.
Thank you. Oh, sorry, guys. I have the mic.
Okay, go ahead. Yes.
My name is Crystal. I'm a caregiver. Thank you very much for being here this morning. It was very informative. So I'm hearing a lot about B cells, but I was wondering more about T cell and what kinds of new therapies are being developed or in the works for T cell lymphoma.
Yeah. It's a very good question, and I think Ronan alluded to the difficulty in doing clinical trials in T-cell lymphoma because it is often hard to diagnose and less frequent. So there are fewer patients worldwide that have T-cell lymphoma. And I mean, there are kind of hopefully new drugs coming on the market. So brentuximab would be one drug that is hopefully going to be covered for proportion of people that have a certain type of T-cell lymphoma called anaplastic large cell. That seems to be a very good drug. And it's also being combined with chemotherapy. So there is that antibody. There's other drugs coming for T-cell lymphoma. I mean, it's T-cell lymphoma is a challenge, I agree. I mean, I think we've tried over the years to combine chemotherapy drugs in different ways to try and do stem cell transplantation perhaps a little bit earlier for folks that have T-cell lymphoma. And I can't say, although we have had some success over the years, it's not been a great success like it's been comparing rituximab and B-cell lymphoma. Ronan, did you want to add anything on that for T-cell lymphoma? Romidepsin, yeah. Romidepsin is an HDAC inhibitor that is not yet officially on the market, but some of the clinical trials do show that it has some activity. And it is a drug that can be accessed right now. There's a special program through Health Canada and the company, and it just got Health Canada notice of a compliance. So we're hoping that that's going to be... but, you know, it's still... the T-cell lymphoma situation is still difficult, but romidepsin is one drug that we may have available, say, in 2014, that would add to our treatment possibilities. There were some more questions here.
What's the percentage of reoccurrence of large cell versus T-cell lymphoma?
Yeah, so the questions around the recurrence risk of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So a lot of the recurrence risk depends on the IPI risk factors when somebody first presents. And now what we understand and what Ronan had presented, some of the genetic studies or the pathology studies that we can do on the cells now under the microscope will also give us some hint as to whether the lymphoma is a higher or an average risk of recurrence. I usually tell people the recurrence rate is about 50-50, but it could be, you know, some people with diffuse large cell are easily cured, meaning like the cure rate could be 80 or 90%, and other people less easily cured where the cure rate may only be 40 or 50%. And that depends on how they present, on their IPI risk factors, and also on some of the pathology that we can test for right now. Not the fancy gene sequencing that Ronan talked about. That's the new initiative, but existing tests that we can do right now in the lab. There was another question, yeah?
Yeah, you've indicated some very promising drugs to be coming online, and they go through extensive testing with your clinical trials and whatever, eventually approved by the FDC and Health Canada. But then when it comes down to a provincial level, Ontario, they don't have a very good record for, how would you say, approving some of these, and they continue to say, we want more evidence. This must be frustrating for a lot of cancer patients that know there's a drug out there and they can't get it.
Yeah, and that's frustrating for you, frustrating for us as well. So I think what's changed, hopefully now, for the better. So the whole thing was really a bit of a mess before. So Health Canada approves a drug, saying, you know, you can market. So basically, Health Canada, the approval from Health Canada, even though we have there's national health care in Canada, right? Like everyone has health care provincially. Health Canada approval doesn't mean that the drugs are automatically covered. That's because drug funding falls to the provinces, not to the federal government. And it's been like that for eons. And that's, in the short term, that's not changing. But what the provinces have done now is, and the government, is they've created this entity called PCODR, P-C-O-D-R, Pan-Canadian Oncology Drug Review. So it's trying to make the process quicker for assessing the value of a new drug versus its cost and benefits and risks in some cases, and then providing quick recommendations to the provinces. So for example, and I think it is working better, maybe it's not perfect yet, it's working better than the old system where things were totally up in the air. So right now, say I have a new drug for lymphoma, I give it to Health Canada, they look at it, they approve it, then the file goes to PCODR for analysis. So PCODR has 3 to 6 months to look at the drug. They have a panel of experts. These are experts in lymphoma or breast cancer or lung cancer, depending on what drug is trying to be brought to market. And they will generate recommendations for the drug based on the clinical studies. They will say that we recommend the drug or we don't recommend the drug. Or we recommend the drug, but it seems expensive. That's another recommendation. So that process, I think, is going through a little bit more quickly than it used to. And then at the provincial level, at least in Ontario, I can tell you that we're very, very keen. Once we have a PCODR recommendation that's positive for a drug, we want to move that drug quickly. So through Cancer Care Ontario. So we have processes in place. We know when PCODR comes to his decision, and there's a meeting usually that same month with the provincial authorities to get the drug through as quickly as possible. And then, of course, once Cancer Care Ontario says, yes, we're going to go with this drug, it's going to be funded through the cancer system, it's going to be provided provincially at no charge, then it's basically Queen's Park signs the check. And sometimes signing the check takes 2 to 3 months, sometimes less. But I think with the PCODR system now, the new thing that's been in process for the last year or two, my impression has been drugs have been coming through more easily, more streamlined. Like, you know, in the last year or two, for blood cancers, there's a lot of activity. So brentuximab is one drug. Velcade for myeloma patients before their transplant, that got approved and covered. There's a drug for myelofibrosis called ruxolitinib that got approved. There's actually a number of other drugs that have had fairly, and these are not cheap drugs, these are drugs that are very expensive, but the government sees the value, and we get them through as quickly as we can. Yeah, but it still is frustrating because it's a provincial by provincial decision, and why couldn't we just have one national drug funding program, right, for all drugs? But I don't see that changing soon. Ronan, any comment about that?
Well, it's a heck of a good question this fellow's asked. What Thomas said is true. I mean, there's a very, people don't want to be mean or anything, but there's a system set up and they recognize that the stakes are very high here. So, you know, if there is a drug that's come about that can save lives, and that's what it's all about, really, you know, the time crunch becomes very important. The problem is there's so many people at the table making the decision. Some are doctors, some are sort of administrative people. I don't want to say the bean counters, but they're there, right? And they're trying to use all these formulas and analyze the data, and all this stuff takes time. But if you're a patient, I need help now. We're here to save lives. What this is all about. So amidst all that complexity, I just have one simple thing in mind. What's best for the patient? That's all that matters for me. I'm here to help patients. What's best for the patients? That becomes my view.
Now, there are circumstances where the data is too preliminary, and some centers come up saying, we've cured cancer, but it's on just a few patients, just in one center, and it's overblown. And that's actually dangerous because you kind of figure there's this magic bullet out there when it's not there. It's false information. And it leads people, it gets them all upset for no reason. But once a drug, not even a baby, has shown that it saves lives, it makes you live longer, then the clock starts. That drug needs to get out to the patients ASAP. But government, that's kind of the way we run things. Now, the system is bulletproof in terms of making sure this is a drug that's safe for the patients, that all the data is rigorously approved. They're doing that for you guys, just to make sure there's no BS about how this thing's coming forward, that it's the real deal. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, a lot of the people at the table don't know anything about lymphoma. They're this weird disease and whatever. Now, I'm not saying you come running up to Queen's Park with pitchforks. Obviously, that's perfect. But there's ways for patients to work in the system, to educate, so that the people that are making decisions look at a patient and say, oh, wait a sec, now I get it. Now I understand why this is so desperate for this patient. So this is the power of Lymphoma Canada, Sue, who's been there, she's been at the table with the government, with patients, and she's moved the needle. Congratulations to Sue, wherever she is there. She's done it before. And so this is where you coming together, all you people here today, it's a tremendous turnout, but you're part of that process. You're not just sitting back as a passive person. So there is opportunities to fight when you have to, but fight properly, fight logically. You don't want to get up to the table and slam your fist. You want to see, how can we help? How can we move things along? How can we be part of it in a professional manner? And so that's where you join in it. The delays are always going to be there. They're heart-wrenching, anxiety-provoking, but that's where things are. It's a challenge, as Tom says. The good work that Tom and all the people are doing at the table, congratulations to them, because they're moving the needle on this stuff. It just wants to get quicker.
And I think just to talk about P-Coder as a new process, you know, when P-Coder was developed federally, it was the first time that actually they actually asked patients what they thought about this new drug coming to market, right, through the respective, like Lymphoma Canada, for example, or Myeloma Canada for a myeloma drug. That's a new thing, you know. Health Canada or the national, never asked people, like, these are patients and caregivers. So if you do, and Sue, you can talk at some point about how people can get involved with, say, Lymphoma Canada to help out when that process comes, because the timelines are very tight, but there's patient feedback that goes back to P-Coder, and I'll tell you, that has helped tremendously, and for them, to help them to make a decision about what their recommendation is going to be for a drug. Because if a drug looks, if it's a little bit borderline, but the patients are all supportive of it and very much in favor because it brings them value, that will help. Are there any other questions before the break?
Yeah. Are there any advances to tackling cancer stem cells, or with respect to lymphoma especially?
Ronan's probably better to answer that one.
Without question, that's a fantastic question, and it kind of gets back, you know, we're kind of looking at the downstream stuff, but it's kind of getting back to what's happening higher up, that the origin of the cancer in its earlier forms. We're not there yet. The studies are going on, some very exciting stuff going on. What I can say is that we don't talk about it a lot, but there are circumstances where we're using stem cells from a healthy donor to cure people. Some forms of lymphoma that seems to work quite well. And so this idea of allogeneic transplants, where you're obtaining stem cells from a healthy brother or sister, or sometimes even an unrelated person, is quite effective. It's just a very toxic thing making that happen. Putting new stem cells into a patient is a commitment of about 2 years before you make it happen. So, but they are happening, and it is a signal. If you can fix the stem cells, you can cure the disease. So your question is a very good question.
So we can question here. Yes.
What is the risk of recurrence of mantle cell lymphoma after a stem cell transplant and rituximab?
Yeah. So the question is around the risk of recurrence in mantle cell lymphoma after a transplant and rituximab. So unfortunately, mantle cell lymphoma has been a difficult one for us to treat ever since we identified it as a separate subtype. So even after a stem cell transplant and maintenance rituximab, I think the majority of people will experience a recurrence. We hope that the recurrence is delayed for several years later, and that's a big thrust of one of the priorities, I think, for the lymphoma research community worldwide is to get new drugs or treatments for mantle cell lymphoma, because that has been a difficult one over the years to treat. It seems to be like follicular, like it has a tendency of recurring, but it does so in a less casual way, like it tends to recur more frequently, like earlier than other types of low-grade lymphomas. Yes, here?
No, I just have a really quick question. It's about the relevance trial. Is
yes.
it coming to Northern Ontario? Because my mom comes from Sudbury. I just wanted to know.
That's a good question. I can check on that.
Yeah, just for
yes. There is a clinicaltrials.gov website. It's the one from the NIH. They will list that study, and they will list the Canadian participating centers. There's multiple centers in Canada, and Ottawa might be one center. I'm not sure if Sudbury will be a center for that study.
Okay.
So can you help this woman get in contact?
You know, again, Lymphoma Canada, a fantastic organization that can get you all the information.
Thank you. I was going
to
say, I never come to the booth at all.
The booth, yeah. Okay. Maybe we're okay for time. We can always cut lunch down a little bit because the discussion and the questions are excellent. So maybe we should take another question or two.
It's a very general question. We don't really know what causes cancer, but could it be chronic systemic inflammation?
It's a good question, and I think to some degree there is some role for chronic systemic inflammation. I'll talk about it a little bit when I talk about my nutrition advice. It's a little pet hobby of mine to read nutrition articles, but as the nurse practitioners know on the ward when I'm on service. But I do think, and if you look at trends in human diseases, say in the developed world, in the last 50 years, what do we see, right? We see cancer, we see obesity, we see type 2 diabetes, we see cardiovascular disease, and we see autoimmune diseases like the inflammatory arthritides. And those things, there is some common elements there. There is an inflammatory signal for a lot of those diseases. There are overlaps, like we know that people that have autoimmune diseases may be at risk of lymphomas, for example. We know that obesity is a risk factor for other types of cancer and for heart disease. These things are interwoven. So I do think that there is some role, probably, for chronic inflammatory states in terms of cancer risk overall, because I think that's what we've observed at a population level. The difficulty is humans are not rats. Like, biologically, we're not rats, and you can't keep people in a cage legally and feed them pellets of stuff and then see what happens in 30 years, right? So, you know, we have to some degree, we have to look at populations over time to see these people that live in this area of the world, here's how they look. This is what they tend to eat or do. These are the diseases they get and what happens to them, right? So there's a lot of that interest, like epidemiological research, that I think helps to inform us about your question. But I do think that there is some truth to that. Over here? What, one question? Yeah.
You were saying that in 2014 you're going to be starting a new drug or testing a new drug.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, how long does the patient have before they go on chemo?
So the question is around drugs that are in clinical trials that don't work, right? So say in that relevant study, somebody gets randomized to the experimental arm, the Revlimid and the rituximab, and say 2 months later, you know, the disease is getting worse, then they're off study, basically. So the clinical trials are very, as Ronan has said, very carefully constructed, with patient safety is number one, two, and three. Number one, two, and three, which is why the consent forms are like a telephone book. And unfortunately, you know, if somebody burped getting Revlimid, that's going to be in the consent form. Because, and sometimes, you know, it is good to tell people what could possibly go wrong on a clinical trial. On the other hand, you know, it can be a little bit counterproductive, because then the person gets this consent form to read and like, wow, like, you want me to participate in this study? But, you know, patient safety is paramount in these clinical trials. People are monitored on clinical trials like hawks, because we measure things in clinical trials way more frequently than we normally do. And, you know, there's literature to suggest in the last 20 years, people that participate on trials do better than people that do not participate on trials. Now, that could be because they're motivated, they're healthier, but there's something to be said about being in a structured clinical trial where you get every question asked every single week or two you're there. So patient safety is not an issue. Good, that was fantastic. Well, for the sake of time, why don't we break for, say, 10 minutes? We'll resume at 11:15. Bathrooms are outside, coffee and snacks. Stretch your legs a little bit, and maybe we'll meet back around 11:15. Thank you.